If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTRadio.live. This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
G'day, I'm Mark Latham, coming to you from Sydney, Australia, the New South Wales Parliament House, where I'm a member. I'm filling in for Chris Smith, who's away today, with a medical procedure. I'm sure it'll be a great success. We love Chris. He's a wonderful broadcaster, and he'll be back with you for the rest of the week. It's my pleasure to fill in for Chris. And, of course, at TNT Radio, we never go home. We're committed to bringing you our take on the biggest topics of our time. We broadcast live 24/7 online globally, no matter what. We've got you covered on today's News Talk TNT. And thanks very much for joining me for the next 2 hours. Can I just start with a commentary about an issue that's raised with me constantly as a member of the New South Wales Parliament? And that is the renaming of locations, streets, even train stations and art institutions with Aboriginal names. It seems to be one of the easiest forms of virtue signalling in our society. While towns in Western New South Wales are shoulder deep in crime, child sexual abuse, school truancy and welfare dependency, the political elites can cleanse their conscience by naming something Indigenous. Now, of course, the left in another context would say this is cultural appropriation, taking the unrecorded words of a nomadic culture that had a very different understanding of geography and location and fitting them in today's Western notions of what a suburb, a train station, an arts museum might be called. And it's been fascinating for me to do some research on this, to go back 30 years to see what the experts had to say about this process. That was a time when academic analysis and public policy on Aboriginal affairs was actually evidence-based in Australia. And if you look at that literature from the 1990s and a little while after, there are three main problems with the renaming of locations with their Aboriginal names. The first is that the Indigenous, as a nomadic culture, had a very, very different notion of what place and location might be. They often use place names as markers for dreamtime stories, a general notion of where legends and myths were created. And as you can imagine, these markers were mobile, changing from time to time and handed down from generation to generation. For example, a hero killed a kangaroo somewhere, sometimes in multiple spots, with exactly the same name. These names were never intended to be used on Western maps. And today when they are, it's rarely with a strong degree of reliability. In fact, one of the experts, Harold Kosh, writing in his 2009 book, said that, and I quote, "Reconstruction is a method for gaining knowledge of the past that is not available through direct transmission. The results of reconstruction are nearly always incomplete and to some extent hypothetical." So essentially, we're talking about guesswork with these Aboriginal names, and there are three main problems. The first of those is the vagueness of the Indigenous notion of what is a location. They did not have a fixed sense or notion of habitation, of work, of a destination that they were intending to visit. So you're talking about a culture and names that were never intended for this process. The second problem is that the Indigenous had no written language, no books, no maps. And by and large, the names that we're talking about relied on the early colonial settlers writing them down and having an accurate record of them. In problems of translation, not understanding what was meant, then this was rare indeed. As Indigenous languages died out, mostly by the turn of the 20th century, Aboriginal place names survived only as the names that had been adopted by Europeans. Here in Sydney, for example, Parramatta, Maroubra, Coogee and Woolloomooloo, also Bondi. This process was often inaccurate as the Westerners found it hard to comprehend the loose Aboriginal notion of place, as well as trying to record a reliable translation of what had been said. Invariably, they wrote down words that weren't actually meant as place names in the Western sense, recording the names of animals, weather events, dreamtime stories and other nouns used in everyday tribal language. And it's created enormous confusion. The third problem is an obvious one. We're talking about nomadic cultures, tribes who hunted and moved across the countryside, and their geographic areas overlapped. So very often we've got the elites with these Aboriginal names picking the name of a particular tribe and discarding the name of another one. What an act of disrespect. We hear all these lectures about respecting Indigenous culture. Well, what about the disrespect of disregarding tribal names in the areas that overlapped? Also the disrespect of using names that, quite frankly, are inaccurate. If you go to my Facebook page tomorrow, Mark Latham's Outsiders, you'll see a longer essay on this and how names like Darrick, Tharawald are not accurate in their use. And here in the middle of Sydney, there's a classic example. We call this Gadigal land, but it was first identified by Governor Arthur Phillip in a letter to Lord Sydney in February 1790, but not as Gadigal as we know it today. Phillip reported that, and I quote, "From the entrance to the harbour along the southern shore to the cove adjoining this settlement, the district is called Cadi, the tribe Cadigal, and the women Cadigalian." So whoever wiped out the recorded names of Arthur Phillip that he used and introduced Gadigal as a name that even now has a new metro station named after it. And my essay goes on with similar confusion and errors that are made in the Sydney suburb of Maroubra and major national landmarks like Botany Bay and our national capital of Canberra. So this is by and large a left-wing invention. It causes confusion when you rename a place. And some of these places have two names now, the traditional European name and the manufactured Aboriginal name. But even that Aboriginal name is rarely accurate in the sense of reliability. So it's a major problem. And in the second hour, I'll be talking about some of the fallacies of introducing Aboriginal language studies and courses in our New South Wales schools. Another waste of time and money by and large. But can I just say my first guest, it's a pleasure to introduce my parliamentary colleague, the Honourable Rod Roberts, who's the Deputy President of the New South Wales Upper House, our standing expert on law and order, because he served with great distinction as a New South Wales police officer and lectured at the Police Academy in Goulburn. Thanks for joining us, Rod.
Thanks for having us on the show, Mark.
Rod, Sydney's been rocked. It's been international news. People around the world have taken note of the dreadful knife attack at the Bondi Junction shopping centre that killed six women, and also the knife attack at the Assyrian church in Wakeley in Fairfield. What's been your take on these dreadful tragedies?
Well, first of all, Mark, they are dreadful tragedies, and I extend my condolences and best wishes to the families of those victims from Bondi. But Mark, you know, this sort of thing is inevitable when we have the system that we have at the moment. Now, your listeners may not be aware of this, and I don't want to go back too far into history, but back in about the 70s, I think it was what was known as the Richmond Report. And up until that, Mark, we had people that had serious mental health issues, and that's what I'm talking about here, people with, bad psychiatric issues were housed in facilities all around New South Wales. And some of the names like Callum Park and Roselle and Morissette and Kenmore might resonate with some of your listeners. And the people were maintained in those facilities. They were supervised. They had a roof over their head, three meals a day, ensuring that they got their medication that they needed. They were employed in the farm areas on some of these properties. They were gainfully occupied. Now, the Richmond Report basically said, this is inhumane, and we need to release these people into the public. And what we'll do is we'll give them their medication in the public, and they can live out there with the rest of society. Well, all well and good in theory, Mark, but look what's developed in practice. We have people that are absolutely homeless, living rough on the streets. We have people that don't take their medication. There's no one to supervise them. And, of course, it leads to unfortunate instances such as the one at Bondi last week. So a terrible state of affairs, and one that's been allowed to develop over the years by government. Look, you know, you walk down the streets of Sydney, so do I, so do your listeners, walk down various towns around Australia and around the world, and you see people, you cross paths with people that you're extremely wary of. And these are the people I'm talking about. We're not talking about people with depression or some other form of mental health. We're talking about these ones with deep psychotic issues that need to be, for the benefit of the rest of society, they need to be placed in facilities where they can be supervised and looked after.
Absolutely. And the Richmond Report has a lot to answer for. I think the attack at Bondi, in some respects, was inevitable. Rod, there's been speculation in New South Wales, even today, about changing the knife laws, because these were knifing attacks in both places. And in Queensland, they have these metal detection wands where the police have got a power to randomly run the wand over a suspect on the street or elsewhere and see if they've got a knife on them. How do you think that would work in New South Wales?
Well, look, I'm a big supporter of it, Mark. You know, there's always a cry from the civil libertarians that you're infringing on people's, rights. Listen, if you're walking down the street and you don't have a knife, you have nothing to be concerned about. In fact, you should be emboldened and you should be grateful that there is steps taken in society to keep you safe. I mean, it's worked up in Queensland at the moment. I know a number of unions stepped forward today, the Police Association, the Public Service Association, Rail, Train and Bus Union, the Health Services Union. Because don't forget, it was only 12 months ago that we had a paramedic stabbed to death in Sydney while sitting in the back of his ambulance having a McDonald's burger doing his paperwork. This is not a knee-jerk reaction. These have been ongoing issues, and it's something that needs to be dealt with. And this is going to back Minns into a bit of a corner, mate. Our Premier Minns, you've got all these unions, very strong unions coming out this morning and saying this is the protection that we need. It'll be interesting to see what the left of his party do, all the hand-wringers, those that want to be apologists and blame everybody except the offender. It'll be interesting to see what sort of pressure they put on Minns, and this will be a bit of a test for him, I think, Mark. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, a big test, because he's got the left and right-wing factions of his party and not many practical people there too committed to law and order. Most of them are lefties, and they seem to put these vague notions of civil liberty ahead of practical measures to protect people on the street. But Rod, you've advanced some data about the degree of knife versus firearm offences in New South Wales over the last 3 years. The statistics are amazing, aren't they? That just have a look at murder in New South Wales, 93 by knife, 43, so half by a firearm. And total, when you go through attempted murder, a domestic, non-domestic assault and robbery, you've got over 6,500 offences by knife and not even 800 by a firearm, so a factor of 8 to 1. It does call out for stronger measures against those wielding knives in our society, doesn't it?
Oh, most certainly. I mean, it's evidence-based, Mark, and you always hear from the lefties, oh, follow the science. Well, here's the science laid out in front of them, but yet nobody seems to be taking this serious. I mean, we've had these last two incidents in Sydney that have sort of, really shocked people into how bad knife crime is. But this has been bubbling away below the surface for some time. And it's going to need a government with some intestinal fortitude to stand up and say, OK, enough's enough. We're going to introduce these wanding techniques, to search people that we reasonably suspect are carrying a knife in a public place. I've heard arguments, we need to ban knife sales. Well, Mark, let me tell you, that is not something that I support. There are those with a genuine need for a knife, fishing people, hunting people, etc. And listen, if you bar those sort of knives, I can guarantee you the next knife will be the Wiltshire Stay Sharp out of the kitchen drawer.
And we can't bar
those. How are we going to cut up our roast?
There's big knives you can get in the kitchen. Yeah, that's the reality of it. You can't ban knives, but you can have these wands that detect troublemakers carrying a knife.
Exactly right. There's no need to be carrying a knife in a public place. Absolutely no need at all. The only person you could imagine with a lawful excuse, in around public transport or something, perhaps is maybe a chef going to work. But look, as far as I know, most chefs leave their knives at work anyway. And I'm sure if you had a reasonable excuse, you would be covered under the legislation. But we need something like this because, Mark, people have forgotten about this, and it was probably swept under the carpet a bit because of the news of Bondi. It was only on the Friday night before the Bondi that there was those two young fellows stabbed out at Doonside, and one of them died as well. So, these knife attacks are very serious, and they need the government to step up and do something about it to protect us, the innocent people in society. Forget the civil liberties of these crooks that want to walk around, these crooks and would-be gangsters walking around with knives in their back pocket. Who cares about their civil liberties? What about protecting the good, honest, law-abiding citizens of this state?
Yes, well, we have random breath testing for drink driving in New South Wales, so random knife wand detection would be the equivalent of that. But on that subject, Rod, you've been very strong publicly on the problem of drug driving in New South Wales, people driving under the influence of illicit drugs. And some of the data is completely alarming, isn't it? I saw where in the drug tests that are undertaken, minimal compared to alcohol tests, people driving around New South Wales, it's likely that 1 in 6 of the cars surrounding them is someone who's a drug driver.
Yep. Well, again, the evidence, and this is evidence I obtained via the Parliament in the asking of questions from the police minister to get the exact data. Mark, and I don't want you to quote me on the exact figures. I don't have them in front of me at the moment, but we do millions of alcohol tests each year because drink driving was an issue and probably still is an issue today, right? And I'm not suggesting we neglect drink driving, but we do millions of tests a year and we end up with a positive test rate of under 1%. Under 1% of drink driving. So the message is getting through. There's still those that are choosing to ignore it and thumbing their nose at society, and we need to keep an eye on them and continue to do random breath tests. But conversely, the figures show we only do about 170,000 drug tests a year around New South Wales, but 15% are positive. So surely that would tell you the main issue, the main concern we've got on roads in New South Wales at the moment is drug drivers, not so much drink drivers. And I'm calling for the police minister and the commissioner to focus the resources they have on drug drivers, because clearly that's the problem. Now, I know that there's not unlimited resources and we don't have, you know, thousands of coppers. In fact, we've got a shortage of police, as we know. But the limited ones that we have, let's target the problem areas, and the problem area is definitely drug driving.
Well, stay with us, Rod. We'll go to a break right now. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Latham in for Chris Smith, and you're listening to TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. Thelightpaper.co.uk.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Now we're talking.
TNT.
We're talking, all right. I'm talking to Rod Roberts, member of the New South Wales Upper House. Rod, there's a big law and order agenda then in New South Wales. How do you think the police minister, Yasmin Catley, and also the police commissioner, Webb, have been performing? They've been in the spotlight mainly for the reason of not fronting up to press conferences and giving the people of New South Wales confidence in the work of the magnificent, hardworking New South Wales police force.
Mark, they've both been missing in absence, missing in action. I've been quite vocal on various media forums about the poor performance of both Karen Webb, the police commissioner, and Yasmin Catley, the police minister. The unfortunate thing we have here is we have two inexperienced people put together. We don't have an experienced police commissioner with a novice police minister, or an experienced police minister with a novice police commissioner. Unfortunately, the way things have fallen, we've got two newbies on the job. And up until recently, I was very, very critical of Karen Webb. And the main reason is, you've touched upon, completely missing in action. It started with the Claire Nowlan tasering down in Cooma. It took days for the police, for the minister and the commissioner to front the media to explain what happened. And when they did, as I found through parliamentary papers, they misled the media, they misled the public, they didn't give them the true position. And then consequently, of course, after the killing of those two fellows at Paddington, by a serving police officer, and I'll be careful not to nominate all these sort of names, Mark, because you and I don't want to get in trouble with pending court cases. But again, the commissioner was absent. It took 3 days, and it was only after I was spoken to in the media that sparked her into action. Now, all she had to do was come out and, A, put the community at rest. Yes, the suspect is a New South Wales police officer, but let me tell you, we have 18,000 other serving officers who are all have the utmost integrity and credibility about them. This is a one-off incident. Yes, it was a police service firearm that was used, we believe. But there's police service firearms being taken in and out of safes every day, and this is a one-off incident. Put the community's mind at rest. Nothing to fear here. Certainly he's a police officer, but I can guarantee the public that he will face the same scrutiny and investigation as any other member of the public would face. And that's all she had to say. It's not very difficult to get up there and just state the facts. And as for needing a spin doctor, that's not the role of the police commissioner. The police commissioner is not a politician. The police commissioner is not some communications manager from some large multinational firm. She's a commissioner of police. Stand up, give the people of the state the facts, let them know what's happening, and then allow the investigation to go on. So extremely critical, and the minister is exactly the same. In fact, I think the minister's worse, Mark, to be honest.
Well, looking at it from a communication point of view, the police commissioner in particular has control of the information. So it's really a briefing session to let people know, in a sensible, controlled way, the facts that are available to the police. That should be straightforward. That's policing, police commissioner 101, isn't it?
Well, exactly right. Now, we've never seen this as an issue with any other police commissioner before. And as I say, you don't need a spin doctor. You don't need to put gloss or spin on this story. Get up, tell the facts. Tell the community exactly what's going on, put the community's mind at rest, and then that's all you need to do. It's simply a relaying of facts. And in her absence, we saw Dave Hudson, one of the deputy commissioners of police, stand up in her absence constantly and do just that, and did an extremely fine and competent job of doing so. It's not difficult.
Well, another issue, Rod, is the so-called juvenile crime crisis in Western New South Wales, and let's be honest about it. We're mainly talking about Indigenous offenders. In the Parliament, we see the National Party, the old Country Party, raising this as an issue. But they're in government for 12 years. They had a police minister at the end there, Paul Toole, who was as useful as pockets in your underpants. Aren't they responsible for allowing this to get out of control, particularly with bail laws that we had, where a young Indigenous offender would do the wrong thing, break into someone's house, steal a car, be involved in street crime, and then be bailed out, do it again, be bailed out, do it again? It was a real revolving door, wasn't it?
Yes, and I'm chuckling to myself, Mark, because it's so hypocritical of the National Party because, as you say, Paul Toole was useless. But Paul Toole not only was a member of the National Party, but lived in a rural and regional town as well. So we should have been well aware of what was taking place. This hasn't been an overnight revelation. This has been building for some time. And the bail laws were weak. I argue even after the twinkling in the edges that the Minns government did, you know, in our parliament about 3 weeks ago, they are still weak and they need strengthening. And I mean, I know it wasn't a juvenile offender, but the incident that's happened out at Forbes there with the tragic murder of Molly Ticehurst is another sad indictment on the bail system that exists in New South Wales at present.
What's the ideal system that you'd like to see?
Well, we've got to hold these magistrates accountable for their actions, Mark. Here's a fellow that... So the poor victim, Molly, is intimidated, stalked, allegedly raped by this fellow out there. She goes to the police seeking help, which is, of course, natural and what she would do. The police arrest this character. They charge him. They bail refusing. They put him before a court. And next day, court releases him on bail. So somewhere at some stage, these magistrates need to be held for account. Now, I can tell you, Mark, when these coroner's inquests happen, looking into the cause of deaths, you never see the coroner criticise another magistrate. They never criticise them. Oh, if this magistrate hadn't let so-and-so out on bail, this murder might never have happened. That's never written in a report anywhere. It's just swept under the carpet. Remember Man Monis at the Link Cafe, released on bail, went on to hold up that siege and unfortunately led to the tragic deaths of those people at the Link Cafe. Nobody ever questions, who was the judge? Why did he release them on bail? No, it's just forgotten about. So magistrates need to be held to account, and it's up to Michael Daly, the Attorney General, to tap them on the shoulder and say, you are not meeting community expectations. The community expect to be safe. Now, let's look at that case study of this young lady out at Forbes because it's very recent in our mind. She went to the police. As I said, the police did their job, yet the magistrate chose to let this character out on bail, and a couple of days later, poor Molly's dead. What's the use of an AVO, a piece of paper, if this person is going to, not conform with the AVO? These magistrates need to get tough, Mark. That's what they're there for. There's huge sentences available and provisions in the Bail Act to keep these people in custody if you're fearful that they're going to continue to commit crimes. Now, we're talking about serious crimes. He's raped this girl, he's intimidated, he's stalked her in her own home. You can't be safe in your own home. What's the use of the system that we have?
Yeah, well, it's magistrates. It's not just a question of being tough, being realistic. They're there to enforce the laws determined by the parliament, not to take the matter into their own hands and enforce a different set of principles and laws that don't actually exist. That's the thing, isn't it? Magistrates being accountable for actually doing their job.
That's exactly right, and that's what they need to do. We at Parliament, if there's incidents like this and there's groundswell of community angst and desire for change, we change the laws, we change the penalties, we change these things. But magistrates just choose to ignore it, go down their little folly of, the poor offender. Well, what about the poor victim? Who's looking after the rights of these victims? It's the same out in these country towns that we touched upon with this, kids breaking into homes and stealing cars and all this sort of stuff. Who's looking after the poor, law-abiding citizens? And I see Mins out there the other day with some football stars. We're going to take at-risk youths and give them one-on-one mentoring with NRL stars and make them to Sydney for training and give them a jersey. What are we giving the victims of crime? What are we doing for them? Absolutely nothing. So this is all tits up, Mark. This is the wrong way about, mate.
Well, I can tell our listeners, Rod, that you're looking after the general public with the work you do on this and other issues. So congratulations on that. You're one of the few MPs speaking out sensibly about law and order to make the public safe. It's one of the basic responsibilities of the state to ensure that its citizens are safe. So congratulations on what you do. We'll talk to you later on, most particularly here in the Parliament. Thanks for joining us, Rod. And right now, we'll go to the news headlines and be right back. I'm Mark Latham, and this is TNT Radio.
This news just in.
TNT Radio News.
Ready? Go, go, go.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. Russia's taken aim at the US, accusing Washington of pushing the world to the brink of nuclear war. Moscow claims to have captured another village in the Donetsk People's Republic. Germany has arrested three of its own citizens accused of spying for China. And a former White House aide who advised then-President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been charged with child sex offences in the UK.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Well, thanks for joining us, and it's my pleasure to say we're going to be talking about a very important subject of climate change alarmism, and I'm joined by an expert in this field, Ian Plimer, who's a professor of earth scientists at the University of Melbourne. He was professor and head of earth sciences after serving at the University of Newcastle as professor and head of geology. He was professor of mining geology at the University of Adelaide and has published more than 140 scientific papers. He was one of the editors of the 5-volume Encyclopedia of Geology, a magnificent volume of work. Thanks for that, Ian, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Mark.
Now, Ian, we're hearing a very torrid debate at the moment about misinformation. That's the theme that's out there. We've got the Communications Minister in Canberra, Michelle Rowland, saying she'll bring in a bill to deal with so-called fake news all over the place. And there's a brouhaha erupted between Elon Musk and the Australian Prime Minister over the rights of Twitter and social media to have a freedom to publish what is factual and truthful, and the rights of Twitter and social media to have a freedom to publish what is factual and truthful, in this case, the video of that knifing incident at the Assyrian church in Fairfield. But if we're talking about misinformation, Ian, then climate change would have to take the cake, wouldn't it? I mean, where's the legislation to deal with the facts on climate change? Can you give us some of those facts, please?
Well, we've never had a debate on climate change. We've only ever had one view, And if you espouse that view, you're labelled a denier, which has got pejorative associations. There's never been a debate, and there's never been the fundamental facts raised. Number one, no one has ever shown that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming. So if you can't show it, then why have we got all these wind turbines and solar panels destroying all our great agricultural land? Why have we got destruction of an existing grid system where we've now had to reverse that grid system at the cost of billions to trillions of dollars? So the whole climate change scenario is underpinned by no data. It is a house of cards. And the second thing is, if you were to look back in the past, and that's been my calling, then we have the exact opposite story. And the past is telling us that we've had times when the atmosphere has had thousands of times more carbon dioxide in it than now. We've had atmospheres in the past of 20% carbon dioxide. And what did we have? We had ice ages. We did not have global warming. So there's no evidence from the past that global warming is a result of carbon dioxide. From the more recent past, we've got ice cores that are showing us that every time it warms up, some thousands of years later, we'll get an increase in carbon dioxide. Now, that shouldn't come as a surprise. We know that from elementary chemistry. So we have data pouring out of our ears showing that the story we're being told is demonstrably wrong. It's not a misinterpretation, it is wrong. And by raising those facts, you get accused of being spreading misinformation, spreading disinformation, being a climate denier. I don't deny climate's changed, it's always changed. And for the last 50 million years, we have been cooling. And certainly when humans have been on Earth, and especially in the last 4,000 years, we've had cooling with spikes of warming in Minoan times, Roman times, and medieval times. So you cannot understand the present unless you look back in the past.
Have you had a look at the alarmist predictions that were made, say, 25 years ago or back to the 1990s? How do they measure up today? Because just anecdotally, I live in Western Sydney, where we're always told there are massive heat effects, we're the hottest part on the planet. I've lived there for, well over 50 years, and I don't detect any change in the way in which the weather and the climate operates. So what are these people going on about?
Well, you're quite right. People don't detect any change. They certainly don't detect any catastrophic change. And the evidence from the short term or the medium term or the long term is showing that we have variability. Now, just in the last couple of thousand years, since the time of Christ, we've actually cooled down. And then we went into the Dark Ages, and since the Dark Ages, we've warmed up. Then we went into the medieval warming for a couple of hundred years. We're cooler than those times, about 3 or 4 degrees Celsius cooler. And then since the medieval warming cooled down, we've actually had the Little Ice Age. We've warmed up since then. So if you're going to tell me that this is the hottest day for the last 50 years, 100 years, or 200 years, then you're not putting it into perspective. And the perspective is we have a very long time temperature record, and it's not only from thermometer and infrared measurements, and it's telling us that we have cycles of climate. Now, we've known that. We've only known that for hundreds of years. Why is it we're just ignoring this established information that we've known for so long, and that is that this has got nothing to do with climate. It's got nothing to do with environment. It's all about an elite group controlling you, controlling your purse, and if you dare cross the line, they will shut you up.
What's the worst of these predictions, the most inaccurate? Is it the alarmism they had that the sea levels are rising? I've got at the back of me a Sydney Harbour where there's been measurement of the water levels over well over a century now, and there's no evidence of any dramatic lift in water and sea levels in Sydney. And I don't see any of the elites like Malcolm Turnbull or Barack Obama who live right on the waterside so worried that they start moving out. I don't see Pacific Islands sinking into the ocean. Is this the worst of the predictions?
Well, I'll start with that one first. Sydney Harbour has Fort Denison built on it. That was built in the Crimean War to prevent the Russian Navy from coming into Sydney Harbour. It was started in 1855 and it was finished after the Crimean War finished. It's done a fantastic job. It's kept out the Russian Navy. we have a tidal measuring station on Fort Denison, and there has been less than a centimetre sea level rise in a century. We have got a really long-term record from there. North of there, up your northern beaches at Longreat and Narrabeen, we've got photographs going back to the turn of the 20th century. And those photographs show fishermen's cottages. We've got some of those cottages still existing there. We see that there's no sea level change whatsoever. In terms of the Pacific Islands, then we have had surveys done from satellite imagery of Pacific and Indian Ocean coral atoll islands and island nations. And we've looked at thousands of these islands. Most of them are growing in size. Few of them have shrunk a little bit, and that's because the coralline sand is used for road base and used for cement making and for building. But we've known that. We've known that since 1842 when Charles Darwin put out a book on coral reefs. And he was arguing, following on from ideas in 1833, that coral atolls actually grow as you get an increase in sea level rise. So we've never, ever looked back in the past, looked at past work done by great people like Darwin. So that catastrophe scare has died. But we've had 2,000 years of people telling us the world is going to end. And in my recent book, Green Murder, I had a whole chapter on this. And I looked at scores of these end-of-the-world predictions, those from Paul Ehrlich, those from your dear mate Tim Flannery and others, and they're all telling us that the world's going to end. Now, if just one of those got it right, we wouldn't be here. So if you really want to have a bet, then if someone's going to tell you the world's going to end, you have extremely good odds that they're going to be wrong, like 100% they're going to be wrong. So we've had a long prediction history, and we've got a long history of people big-noting themselves and making it complicated with scriptural interpretations and with mathematics and with science. But the bottom line is that the planet has been around since a Tuesday, 4,557 years ago. We've had cyclical climates, we've had sea level rising, and right at this moment in geological history, we are colder than we've been for a very, very long period of time. Right at this time, sea level is much lower than it's ever been in geological history. So what are we worried about?
Well, we'll talk about the cool weather after we go to a break. Thanks for being with us, Ian. Stay with us, and we'll just have a break and be right back.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
The mornings, that's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
Internet crimes against children in New Mexico are real. And when it comes to protecting your children, the New Mexico AG's office and the ICAC unit are on the front lines. I'm New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas. There's nowhere to hide for online predators in New Mexico. We are working tirelessly using state-of-the-art technology and resources to seek out and find them wherever they are. Please talk to your children about the dangers that exist online. Social media, games, and messenger apps. It's always important to know who you're talking to.
Help fight online predators in New Mexico by submitting a tip today.
Thanks for listening and being a part of the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I'm Mark Latham in for Chris Smith, talking to Professor Ian Plimer about climate change. Professor, you mentioned cooler weather. In New South Wales in the summer of 2019-20, we had dramatic, terrible bushfires, and the alarmist green lefties at that point said this is the new normal, that we will have these catastrophic fires every single summer into the future. Well, of course, with their predictions, in the four summers since, it's been remarkably cool and mild in New South Wales and also very wet. I say of the Greens that if we ever needed a drought, they should tell us it'll never stop raining, because when they said we'll always have bushfires, it started to rain and it didn't stop for a long, long while. So do you think we're getting to the point now where the public is seeing through this hysteria and measuring it against reality, that when the Greens say we'll have very bad bushfires every single summer, and then we have four summers in New South Wales, mild and wet, the public know that this is bunkum?
Well, if we knew our history in Australia, we'd know that the biggest bushfires in Australia were in 1851, and the next biggest ones were in 1939. That was before we were pumping out huge amounts of carbon dioxide, which actually makes our life a lot better and helps our crops and helps our forests and grasslands. So firstly, history says that idea from the Greens is wrong, but you have to remember, as you would well know, the Greens don't read history. If they could read, they might go back and look at the past. There's also global studies done of wildfires, and wildfire intensity and the number of wildfires has been dropping over the last 100 years. Now, we do know of more fires because we have better communication systems. We also do have higher insurance bills with fires because people are wealthier. They build their houses in a forest. Quite often this forest in California is with pines that give out gas which explodes, or in Australia, and eucalypts which give out gas that explodes. And so the Greens have yet again got it totally wrong. But what we do know from history, and more recent history, is that after you've had a period of heavy rains, you get undergrowth really takes off. Now, in Australia, we've had a lack of backburning in our forests. That undergrowth has really taken off, and there's a very strong correlation between heavy rains and then big bushfires a few years later. Now, just to the west of you in Lura, they had massive bushfires in 1957. It almost wiped out the whole town. I remember it. I was a kid in Sydney, and I can remember seeing Lura. There were just one or two houses standing in this town. That is because we had massive heavy rains in 1956. These gave us the great floods at Maitland and in all our big easterly flowing rivers in Australia. And now that we've had heavy rains in eastern Australia in the last couple of years, and because we haven't had backburning, you can expect to have more bushfires. History shows us that. So the Greens have got it totally wrong. The Greens have got it always totally wrong. And I think if the Greens ever say anything, just take the inverse position and you will be right.
Well, that's right. That's what I say here in the New South Wales Parliament. And the debate's becoming less rational, is it? I can remember back to the time of the Rudd government. They commissioned Ross Garnaut to write a major report about climate change. And the report had its flaws, but one sensible thing it said, Ian, is that you can't take a single weather event and say that's climate change. But that's now the standard way of reporting in the media and the green left hysteria, isn't it? That if there's a flood, a drought, a bushfire, it's attributed to climate rather than being identified for what it is, a single weather-related event.
I think that's due to the change in society, where we've become far more narcissistic. And of course, if anything happens in my lifetime, I have to have had an influence on it. I'm very important. And if I fart, or if I light a cigarette, or if I drive a car, then any natural phenomenon that occurs is as a result of my actions. And because I'm empowered with social media to say anything with no rationality, no logic, no knowledge, I can say it. So I think we've had a significant change from a rational society to one which is quite irrational and getting to the point of being totalitarian. And we're seeing hints of totalitarianism in many Western countries at present. And I fear in my country that we are going to become so irrational, we'll become totalitarian, and people who might have an alternative view based on evidence will not be given a platform.
Another issue in this, why is Australia doing this? Why is Australia going to 100% renewable energy when we have 1.3% of global carbon emissions and can't have any tangible, noticeable impact on global climate? And this has been pointed out by former chief scientists and other experts. It's become a secular religion, hasn't it? Climate change, ideology, yeah, regardless of the facts.
And it's got all the hallmarks of a religion. It's got the catechism. It's got the Holy Book, which is the IPCC report, and like most Holy Books, people haven't read them. The latest IPCC report requires a bit of robustness to read it. It's nearly 5,000 pages long. It has its high priests. These high priests are not responsible for anything. They have their indulgences. You have sin. You have all the hallmarks of Christianity. So it has become a religion. And I think it has thrived because we've had a weakening of Christianity in the Western world, but we've also become very wealthy. And I think destruction of a society from within is very common if you're very wealthy, because we ask simple questions. Is this all? Shouldn't I feel guilty about being comfortable, about being wealthy? And concepts of hard work, concepts of distributing wealth disappear. So I think we are in very dangerous social times. And I think partly because we have a Western society which is very tolerant of rat bags, and we have a Western society that's extremely wealthy. We've never been wealthier than we are now.
Well, you've identified an important electoral trend, that the wealthier the voter, the more likely they are to vote on climate change alarmism with the Teals and the Greens and the left wing of the Labor Party. But this is counter to progressive politics in the traditional sense, isn't it, in that these are people who have no problem, apparently, in wiping out tens of thousands of coal-reliant jobs, say, in the Hunter Valley, and turfing entire working-class communities out onto the Centrelink scrap heap.
Well, you used the very important word progressive. And as soon as someone starts talking about we are the progressive party or this is progressive politics, you know that it's retrogressive. The average punter out there trying to feed a family, trying to put bread on the table, trying to pay a mortgage, cannot survive. We had a Labor government, and I remember this from my younger days. The Labor government looked after people. They looked after the poor. They looked after the working man. Much of my life has been in the working class town of Broken Hill, which was the stalwart of the Labor Party in Australia. And that now is totally forgotten. We are having working class people, especially in rural areas, absolutely and totally destroyed. This is not progressive politics. This is politics that is supporting a few mates. Just look at, say, wind turbines. These wind turbines are put in by a select few. These are generally foreign companies. These are companies that have no bond for cleaning up after the mess. And they are welcomed by the ideological left. But the consequences of the actions are not dealt with by those people who call themselves progressives. They are retrogressive. And you've only got to look, and you mentioned coal miners, you've only got to look in the Hunter Valley. This was an area where we had manufacturing, where we had a whole lot of industries plonked around coal-fired power stations, such as an aluminium smelter. And now we're reversing the grid. Now we're destroying those coal-fired power stations. And the average man is going to suffer. And ultimately, the policies will change, but that's when the average person has been through a recession or a war or both. We are putting ourselves into serious economic difficulty in this country, and we are forgetting the average worker.
Where do you think we're headed with energy policy in Australia? We're one of the only countries in the Western world that have adopted a net zero policy setting without going down the path of nuclear energy. This is a great paradox, isn't it, that it's said that we need to do what the rest of the world is doing, addressing climate change, but we won't adopt the nuclear policies that 19 out of 20 of the G20 countries have adopted.
Well, you've raised a lot of subjects there. Firstly, we're very rich in energy. We have millions of years of uranium to be mined in this rock. We have thousands of years of coal and thousands of years of gas. We can go conventional energy. We do not need to use wind and solar, whereby we send money to China and they build this equipment. We can use our own coal and gas in our own fossil-fueled fired power stations in Australia, and that's not sending money outside Australia. The second point is that we did almost go down nuclear in the late 60s, and at Jervis Bay, just to the southeast of you, there are the foundations poured for a 560 megawatt power station. That, for various political reasons, it was a change in the leadership of the Liberal Party, that died. But we would have had a nuclear industry if that power station had been built. We had special institutes of nuclear science and engineering built at the University of New South Wales, and these were lining up to put people in to run these. We have had a nuclear industry in Australia since the 1960s. And that nuclear industry is based around Lucas Heights. We're now onto our second reactor. We are providing medical isotopes for people in the Pacific, in Australia, and we need to have that close to an airport so we can get these isotopes to an aeroplane and get them to the hospital and get them into people. So if ever you've had cancer, if ever you've needed cancer treatment, you cannot be anti-nuclear. We have probably missed the boat for quite a while on nuclear. And we missed it partially because of our own stupidity and partially because coal was just so cheap in Australia. Victorian brown coal produced electricity for 3 cents a kilowatt hour. That was the cheapest in the world. We've destroyed that system now, and we should be looking for a nuclear policy whereby we don't even think about net zero. We think about what is the best for the long-term power production in this country, such that we can have a manufacturing industry that employs people, that's a big multiplier on our primary industries. As for net zero, Germany's pulled out of it. The UK's pulled out of it. When are we going to wake up?
Well, you've mentioned a range of nuclear industries, but there's a new one coming, isn't there? Nuclear submarines through AUKUS. And Chris Bowen, the alarmist energy and climate change minister, keeps saying to the nuclear advocates, where would you put the nuclear reactor? Well, his policy is to have nuclear reactors inside submarines and put them in Sydney Harbour, put them in Jarvis Bay, put them off the coast of Brisbane. So this is a massive hypocrisy, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. And Bowen's the best thing the Liberal Party have got in the federal Labor government. We've had small modular reactors in submarines since the 1950s. That's nothing new. We desperately need submarines for a country this size. We've got plenty of ports where we can service these submarines, plenty of deep water ports, and we should have had these submarines a long period ago, a period of time ago, and I hope we get them. But you cannot have a nuclear medicine industry, which we've got at Lucas Heights, and then a nuclear submarine system and be anti-nuclear. You can't have it both ways. You're either a hypocrite or a fool, and I suspect in Bowen's case, it's perhaps both.
Well, Professor, on another question about net zero and the climate change renewables agenda, there's been no strong analysis in government policy making of have we got enough land in Australia to accommodate the vast demands of wind and solar farms. Now, people looking at Australia might think, oh, that's a ridiculous thing to say. What a big country. You must have enough room to accommodate renewable energy. But I've seen some studies in New South Wales where if you take away the urban land, the prime farm land, indigenous land, national parks, and other environmental land, land that can't be inhabited, there is a real question mark. Is it possible to accommodate 100% renewables in geographic terms? Have you looked at this?
Well, yes, I've read work on it. If you look at the fingerprint of a coal-fired power station, it's very small. For a gas-fired power station, it's even smaller. For a nuclear power station, it's very, very small. And I've lived in a city where there was a nuclear power station in the centre of the city, and that in Munich. We had one at the university there. Many cities have nuclear power stations in the city. They occupy a very small amount of land. But the land that we need for inefficient solar and inefficient wind is absolutely enormous. It's not the land area that is the key thing. It's the sterilisation of this land. The wind industrial facilities don't last very long, at the best 15 years. We have masses of concrete and steel to get rid of, and there is no bond, there is no policy where the power generator has to clean up their mess after they've made it. So it's partly a loss of great agricultural land, partly it's permanent sterilisation of the land, but the third point is that the wind turbines have some very, very poisonous chemicals in the blades, a chemical called bisphenol A. That is banned in most countries in the world. That abrades from the blades. That actually ends up going into the water and the soils when the blades are buried after the useful life, and we cannot get rid of that chemical. That is one of the permanent dangerous chemicals left lying around. And we have the same with solar panels, where they leak out cadmium telluride. Cadmium and tellurium are highly toxic. They end up in farmland. If that farmland is to be used again later, after the end of the solar power industrial complex, then we've got contaminated land. So there are three points why we shouldn't be doing this. And the fourth point is that we've got to reverse the grid. Normally we have our power stations close to where the energy is used. Mm. Now we're putting wind and solar in areas where we've got to put in huge grids. These cover large amounts of agricultural land. That prohibits the use of much equipment in agricultural land. So we're potentially giving ourselves a problem with food security as well as a problem with energy security. Total madness.
Well, we're the only country in the world that has a thing called rewiring the nation, which is massively expensive, inefficient, and as you say, reverses the grid and is untested in terms of the backup power, like the very expensive white elephant, the Snowy 2.0. But Professor, thank you for the work you do. You're very brave in standing up on these issues and articulating the facts. It's been a delight to have you on the Chris Smith Show on TNT. We'll talk to you again in the future, I'm sure. Thanks very much.
And for Thank you, Mark, for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. And for our listeners, we now go to the news at the top of the hour.